Okay, welcome back. Hour number three on a very busy Monday. No days of rest and relaxation anymore. That's over. We're heading into an ever-increasing forward slide, the momentum of which is unstoppable. It's going to rocket us right through October into the cataclysmic month of November, December, grim, violent, January, more of the same. It's going to be tough, so I hope all of you are ready. You have a little bit of time left, if not, so please do give it some serious consideration. Okay, we're going to talk to Dr. Henry Nyman this hour about the latest on the coronavirus situation. We have been with Henry since January 8th was our first regular program on this. We've been doing it ever since and bringing you the latest and most informative scientific explanations from Henry's realm. He is one of the world's top virologists, and we're very honored to have him with us. As you know, we don't agree on everything, but the idea is to bring the professional scientific views forward. We're not getting that from the administration. Forget about it. Not going to happen. Okay, a couple of headlines for you. October vaccine surprise alarms scientists. There is some talk that Trump is somehow going to come up with a vaccine that he is going to suggest be used on Americans before the election. Sometime in mid-October through November the 2nd, that'll be the big press movement to make him look like the savior. It'll be unproven, in my view, completely unsafe and insane to use something at this stage of the game. Crazy. But we've seen a lot of craziness out of this administration. The new Pentagon-Google partnership suggests that artificial intelligence, AI, will soon be used to diagnose coronavirus cases. Okay? There's another story. If the PCR test, which has been given a lot of very close scrutiny by various people lately, is in fact unreliable, as many say, why are health officials demanding the public be tested with it? There's another one to consider. 6 months into the pandemic, and the United States economic outlook is getting gloomier. Well, I think if you listen carefully to the last hour, you'll understand that that may be an understatement. Okay, 2020 has been a nightmare year for America, and the economic fallout is just beginning. Okay? This fits right together, hand in a glove. 50% effectiveness, question mark. AstraZeneca vaccine trial still on hold in the U.S. amid reports of a second victim of a neurological negative nasty side effect. They're calling it a neurological disease case. All right, we'll stop there. The news headlines up right now. They're all there for you to take a look at. Henry, welcome back. Hope you had a nice weekend.
Oh, it's a busy weekend. It's kind of more of the same, as he said. It's probably getting a little bit worse. And I hadn't heard about the second case, so...
I'll send it over.
I had heard that they weren't being forthcoming. I mean, there have been two cases, but there's, and this would technically be a third one if there was another one. They're just talking.
Well, we did know about two. That's right.
There was one in phase one and one in phase three, and the complaints I've heard is that they're not really giving a whole lot of detail on. Either of them, they kind of mentioned them in a investor update by the CEO when the second one happened, and he kind of referred to the first one, and he said that because that one had been referenced on the handout they gave people that were volunteering for the phase three, and this basically told them about the risks, and they said they had one prior event and that they had just temporarily halted the trial. And they described it. And at the time, they didn't say that it was due to MS. They basically said that it was a, this type of, essentially the same thing that had happened in the phase two. And that it was kind of, neurological, but it was an inflammation type of a issue. And I'm reading through this. I'm not seeing a third one. So
I think it's two. Let me read this really quick. This is out of UK paper, The Telegraph. Days after AstraZeneca halted the clinical trials of its COVID-19 vaccine over a case of unexplained neurological illness in one volunteer taking part in the study, the British-Swedish pharmaceutical company released a 111-page trial blueprint that promises an anti-coronavirus drug with 50% effectiveness. That is a quote. This was the first time AstraZeneca revealed a second case of a serious illness in one of the participants of its phase three, as Henry said, trials in the UK. The firm, and I'll wrap this up, has already resumed the trials in the UK, even though one of the participants developed transverse myelitis, an inflammation of the spinal cord, while a diagnosis of a second volunteer remains to be confirmed. However, the New York Times cited a source familiar with the situation as suggesting that the second person suffered the same side effect earlier, but that this had not been reported by AstraZeneca before. It turned out that the, quote, first pause in July was not publicly revealed and the trial was restarted, end of quote, says the article in The Telegraph. All right, there you go.
Right. So basically, yeah, it's kind of a moving target that that they originally said in their handout that the first case, which was in phase one, was caused by transverse myelitis. Then when the second case arose, the CEO held a conference call with investors, and he told the investors that the first case had been investigated, and it wasn't transverse myelitis. It was due to undiagnosed MS. So the patient had the symptoms that were consistent with transverse myelitis, but when they did further investigation, they determined that it wasn't an adverse response to the vaccine. It was symptoms that was caused by an undiagnosed MS condition. And then they modified the second halt. The second halt, they again said it was transverse myelitis. And then after the New York Times published that and then other papers followed on, then they said that the transverse myelitis in the second case had not yet been confirmed. It was under investigation. So both cases gave similar symptoms, except the second case was hospitalized. The first case was not. And both cases were initially identified as transverse myelitis. Hmm. And then they were further investigated. The first one, they said it was MS, but they didn't give details as to, why was it undiagnosed MS as opposed to MS caused by the vaccine? And then for the second one, they just left it open. They said, it looked like transverse myelitis, but we're still investigating to confirm that it is. So basically, there have been only two cases, but there really haven't been there haven't been that many cases that have got the vaccine, because I think that they had a total of 335 cases or something that had received the vaccine in the phase one trial when they made this announcement in the phase two. And the phase two had just begun. It had started in late August. So when they made the announcement of the phase, actually it's the phase two, phase three, when they made the announcement for the current trial, that was too soon after the start of the trial to have even received the second dose. So that patient had only received one dose. And then after review in the UK, they resumed the trial. So more people got the vaccine. But the other countries that had it, including the U.S., so the U.S., India, and South Africa were all conducting phase three trials. And all three other countries halted their trials because of the problem in the UK, and each country has to review the data from the UK, or the two cases from the UK. I think the first one was from the UK also, but wherever that first case was, plus the second case from that was at in the UK, and decide based on their criteria and their overseeing committee that it was safe to resume the trial. And the trial has not resumed in the U.S., and I'm not sure there's resumed in India or South Africa. So far, the only patients that are currently getting more vaccine is the U.K. But the complaints have been that they haven't really been that transparent on exactly, you know, why that first case was diagnosed as MS after the fact, you know, after it was first called transverse myelitis, and why the second case is unconfirmed after, you know, however long it's been since they stopped the trial. And they're not giving enough detail. And apparently this 111-page document says something. I really have to read the document, but it says something about a 50% success rate.
Right.
And 50% was the minimum for approval. So that they've been saying all along that it had to have at least 50%. And many have thought that 50% wasn't that great a number. And it's not clear. I've heard some complaints that for the elderly population, which is the group that's most susceptible, have not been included in the trials. So they're basically running the trials on younger people. And, and so they don't even know how well it's going to perform.
No.
That are most at risk. And so there's all of these kind of unknowns. And the only thing that's known is that Trump is going to say it's ready. And, you know, I don't know why it's taken so long. You know, we're shooting for a record here, and I expect things to be done.
Do you think if he does dare, he's going to go with the AstraZeneca Vax? Is that the one you're thinking he's going to go with?
Well, I think AstraZeneca is furthest along. I think there's three that are in phase three, and that he's not picking one or the other. AstraZeneca's making this news because they've had two halts already, and there's concern that since they're kind of in the lead, they're getting these problems first, and they're all going to have it, because the concern is that this condition has been diagnosed in COVID cases. There have been at least four that I know of that have been written up in the literature. So there's four different cases that have been described as getting the virus and then developing this disease. And So that would raise the concern that the vaccine is mimicking the virus and causing the same problem that the virus causes. And that's not a good situation. And so, if that's the case, then it would seem that this problem that AstraZeneca has isn't going to be unique to AstraZeneca. It's a good chance it's going to be something that is a problem with the vaccine. And then the question is going to be a risk reward. You know, how often does it really happen? And they don't really know because they haven't done enough cases. And that's the reason they're talking about 30,000 cases. And I think Pfizer wanted to bump it up to 64,000 cases. Mm-hmm. And so if they're going to do more, if they feel there's a need to do more cases, then that means that there's a need to get more data, which is an indication that it's even less likely that anything's going to be happening in, you know, October or, you know, something before November. And even if something's announced, then it's going to take a while. I mean, they're talking about 100 million doses, I think, by the end of the year. And then it's an issue of distributing them. And I said that a couple of these vaccines require minus 70 degrees centigrade storage. And I don't know, you know, how widespread minus 70 degree freezers are. And
I don't happen to have one, do you? Jeez.
Well, no, we had them at the lab. The lab
sure.
had them, and they're not cheap, but they are available. But I don't know that they're available in quantity because they are cheap and they're pretty well specialized. And most doctors' offices aren't going to have them. I don't know about drugstores that they give out flu vaccines. Whether they, I mean, whatever I've seen them take out the flu vaccine, you know, they got a little refrigerator, you know.
Yeah, how could they store it at minus 70, Henry, and then thaw it out and give it to somebody? They have to pull them out and let them thaw and have them ready on standby. You couldn't. This is kind of like, it sounds like.
I think it's a storage thing. I don't know that it's that.
Storage shortage, just like ventilators. We got to have more storage, more freezers.
Right, right. I could see there being a freezer shortage. I
yeah.
think that
see?
You know, the minus 70 is not, you know, like it has to be at minus 70 when you walk in the door. It's just that's how you have to store it. So if they know what their frequency of traffic is, that they can, you know, basically have it thawed out so that when you're scheduled to get your shot, they've got, you know, that they've already gone through that process. And it doesn't take that much longer to thaw. You know, it's just a matter of how cold it has to be to make sure that it stays frozen type of a thing. And it isn't going to, I mean, these are lipid vesicles. So these are biologically unstable type of a situation. And mm-hmm. so if you leave them at minus 20 or something, that's a little bit too close. And I don't know, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some type of, you know, preservative that kind of stabilizes the membrane type of a situation. And therefore its freezing point is lower. So for it to be frozen itself, it has to be cool down to a lower temperature than a minus
because of the preservative interfering.
Right, right, right. Because its freezing point is lower. You know, it's like it would have a glycerol or something. You know, mm-hmm. it would have something that wouldn't freeze that easily. It's kind of like, you know, I mean, we used to use stuff that was similar to what in radiators, polyethylene glycol, you know, so if there was polyethylene glycol in it to stabilize these lipid vesicles, which is where the gene is delivered, then the PEG will have a lower freezing point, and therefore to
so that PEG would be actually a component in the shot. It would be in the vaccine, if that's the case.
I think so. No, I mean, I haven't read the packaging label, but I do know that I've frozen cells before, and you know, we include PEG when we freeze cells, and uh-huh. So I'm thinking it's the same thing with these lipid, you know, artificial lipid vesicles, so that they basically have kind of like an artificial cell. It's a cell that's got a lipid, and inside it's got this cassette of genes that are going to turn the spike protein gene on, and you know, once it gets injected, then it starts making the spike protein, and then your immune system starts making antibodies to it, and that's what causes the vaccination. You know, that creates the immune response.
Right.
And so because of that, the way it's delivered, it needs something to stabilize like PEG, and therefore you can't just freeze it at minus 20 like you could if it was just all water.
Well, this is going to present a bit of a problem for widespread storage availability. Labs, yeah, but there's going to be a shortage. So if you all want to make some money, minus 70 freezers is the ticket right now, looks like.
Yeah. Well, they're out there, but, you know, like I said, I don't know if they're out there in quantity. And I'm not sure, you know, how whether that's a barrier to, you know, because they only cost money, they take up space. You know, so it's kind of like if they don't already have a minus 70 freezer, then A, they got to buy it, and B, they've got to have floor space for it, and C, you know, I don't know, there's going to be a whole lot beyond COVID vaccine, and D, it might turn out that the vesicles don't work that well, and it's a lot easier to just basically have some cell line or something, which just needs you know, a more traditional minus 20.
I would think there had to be a better way. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. That because they're out front, it's very possible that this first round of immunizations will involve this, but if it turns out that it does, and especially if it's right at the bottom, I mean, if it's at 50% effectiveness, you know, that you can't really get lower than that and be approved. So 50% is a minimal number, and so if somebody comes up with 60%, you know, and you don't need the minus 70 freezer, that, you know, the freezer you bought for a couple thousand dollars is not real useful because nobody's using that vaccine. They're using the easier one that gives 10% higher. So those are the types of issues that whether, you know, stores are going to go out and buy a bunch of, you know, larger freezers that cost, you know, $4,000, $10,000, or they're going to make a commitment, and of course they take up more space if they're bigger. So if they're going to give the space and the capital expenditure for something that might not last more than a few months or so, because a better vaccine comes along, you know, in first quarter of 2021, and they say, oh, why are we playing around with this? Especially, I mean, it's not just the storage, it takes two shots. So you basically have to, you know, give that shot two times, and you gotta do follow up and make sure that the people that got the first shot come back and, you know, realize that one shot isn't really gonna give them that much protection. And frankly, you know, whether the one shot is one of these situations which leads to enhancement because you kind of got some antibodies, but they're really not that good. And then the virus changes a little bit, and then all of a sudden, instead of inhibiting the virus, it enhances the virus, and they end up getting sicker because they didn't come in for their second shot. You know, or if you really need two shots, other people get sicker because they got infected before their 30 days or their 28 days were up, or it's really, you know, a couple of weeks beyond that before the second
shot. It sounds to me like there's also, excuse me, Henry, there's a potential for, if you get the first shot, there's a potential for enforcement for the second shot, because they could say that you're going to create problems for other people if you don't get your second shot exactly when you're supposed to. I mean, this could get politically pretty dicey for a while. I think they're in unknown waters.
Well, the enforcement part, there's all kinds of issues. And some of these issues are starting to show up in other countries, and they're kind of getting into a situation for addressing it. And that's and that really has to do with quarantine. And they're basically you know, the virus is starting to make a comeback in some of the countries in Europe. And
now that's not Italian. That's not Italian. That's something else. That is the Italian strain making a comeback.
Right. Right. But it's making a comeback because people are, you know, having, you know, pandemic weariness type of stuff. So they're tired of staying inside or limiting, and you know, they figure that it isn't that bad. And so the precautions they've been taking, they are no longer taking. And it seems to be more young people doing it. So they're assuming that, you know, they're not as high of a risk, and so they're doing things that they had been avoiding, and they're starting to get infected. And to control it, you know, the idea is to identify people early and have them quarantine so that they don't extend the transmission chain. And some people are kind of violating the quarantine, so they've been exposed to somebody that's been diagnosed, and they're supposed to quarantine for 10 or 14 days, whatever the number is. And they're basically breaking quarantine. And so I think it was in the UK, they had a fine, a pretty stiff fine of something like $1,300 or something.
I was hanging more than that.
Then, well, no, that was for the first offense. And then subsequent offenses, it could go as high as $13,000. So it was like 10 times higher. But both were relatively big numbers, but the second one was a very big number. And so that's what they were doing with enforcement there. They were basically fining people not adhering to the regulations. Now whether they're going to do that with a shot, if you get the first shot and you don't get the second shot, I don't know. I have my doubts about that. That would be as big of an issue, because you'd have to demonstrate that, you know, that not getting the second shot is worse than not getting any shots, you know, and some people are going to refuse to get any shots, and other people are going to say, well, I took the first shot, my arm was sore, and I didn't think it was good to get a second shot because it would make it worse. And so I don't see, you know, missing a second shot as being that big of an issue, unless it starts to you know, develop that this is very dangerous. But I mean, the danger part, you can make that argument for masks right now. And there's a bunch of stories going on about around the masks. And the one story was the lieutenant governor in Ohio was kind of preparing the crowd because they've got, you know, mask requirements at least for public gatherings or outdoor gatherings. I don't know exactly what it was, but I think it might have been associated with Trump coming to town to do a rally. And he was out there telling the crowd, well, you know, you really need to put masks on. Look, we're giving out or selling. I don't know, but probably we're giving out these red masks that say Trump on them, and you know, trying to get them to wear a mask that says Trump, so it's not political. And they just booed him. You know, they didn't want to wear the mask, even if it said Trump, and even if it was red, and even if it was
Here's another story. This is important. This gets into the area that we have been giving a lot of attention to when the stories appear. If all of you listening remember that some time ago, I don't know, a month ago, we had that story about how 80% of a group, I think it was 100 people that were infected, showed, allegedly, via MRI, heart damage. Damage to the heart after they had, quote, recovered. Some kind of observable heart damage. Okay, we watched that story. That story was essentially debunked to a substantial degree rather quickly. Now, here's a new one. This is a little different, but it has to do with coronavirus and heart health, right? Autopsies have shown that there are traces of the coronavirus's genetic material in the heart and actual viral particles within the heart's muscle cells. I read that again. Autopsies on deceased, I'm not saying they died necessarily of coronavirus, but they had it. Autopsies have found traces of the coronavirus's genetic material in the heart and actual viral particles within the heart's muscle cells. Experiments have found that SARS-CoV-2 can destroy lab-grown versions of those cells. Experiments have shown that SARS-CoV-2 can destroy lab-grown versions of those heart cells. Several studies have now shown that roughly 10 to 30% of hospitalized COVID-19 patients had high levels of troponin, T-R-O-P-O-N-I-N, a protein released into the blood when the heart's muscle cells are damaged. Such patients are more likely to die than others with no sign of heart injury. Now, this is worrying for people with severe symptoms, and I just wanted to bring that out. What do you think?
Well, troponin is what's measured to see if you had a heart attack. I mean, that's diagnostic. So if you had a heart attack, they measure how much troponin you have floating around in your blood. They do a blood test, and the test for troponin is quantitative. And you're not supposed to have any troponin.
And
if you had a low level, like, you know, less than 10 or something, then you had a mild heart attack. And if you have a high level, like 50 to 100, then you had a severe heart attack. And so what they're saying, and I had mentioned this, the troponin levels was something that came out a while ago. And they were talking about low levels in a high percentage of the patients. So they had levels in the neighborhood of 2, 3, or 4. And then they had controls, and the controls like never got above 2. So the controls actually had a little bit, which you shouldn't have at all. And I think these were age matched. So older people had a tendency to have some damage, but they could clearly divide the two groups. So the ones that had COVID, you know, a history of COVID, they had tested positive for the virus, they were in the 2 to 4 range, where the others were in the 0 to 2 range. And it was the type of thing where the two groups were easily distinguished. And so there definitely was more troponin. And then some of them had higher levels. Some of them had 10 to 20. You know, they had, you know, levels that would say they had a moderate type of a heart attack versus a mild heart attack. But almost all of them had the mild heart attack levels. They were in the 2 to 4 range. It wasn't that they were getting cases that had zero. You know, they were pretty rare. So most of them had some low levels of troponin, but that were low, but they were above the controls that were similar age, but they had not tested positive for the virus. And so the reason that study caused concern was because a lot of these patients that did have these lower levels were positive for COVID, but they weren't seriously ill. They weren't patients that had, ended up in the hospital in the ICU and on ventilators. These were patients that basically came in and they were symptomatic and they got tested and they were positive and they recovered and they went home and they never really got that sick, but they had symptoms. They had elevated troponin levels. And
that bothers me to hear this. That suggests that the virus, no matter where it manifests the most pronounced, your lungs, your kidney, whatever, is always going to be involved with the heart to some degree.
Well, fair percent of these, I think they were mostly older patients, but I'm not positive on that, exactly what the age range was. But that was the same type of thing with the football players, that they had seen evidence of damage to the heart, even in asymptomatic cases that were asymptomatic, but had tested positive for the virus. And then what you were saying about the cell lines, these were heart muscle tissues grown in a test tube, and they could add the virus, and the virus would chew up the heart tissue and the heart muscle tissue. So since it could do it in a test tube, there was concern that the virus could have the same effects on the heart. In a person, it would be in vivo. It would be a much more complicated situation. You would have immune response, and you'd have various defenses that the body would put up, and therefore the chopping up of the heart muscles, if you will, by the virus in vitro may not be as severe as in vivo if the host response was
sufficient to
repair it quickly or to kill off the virus. But that's all part of this polybasic cleavage site, because heart muscles known that it's got both the ACE2 receptor as well as the furin protease. So the furin protease is widespread, and it's in heart tissue also. And so those are the two components that are required for the virus to be able to infect that tissue type. If it's got the ACE2 receptor and furin, the virus can get in. Now, if the virus can get in, that's never a good situation. And if it's something like, heart muscle, which you, tend to not turn over a lot, it's supposed to be stable, and you're killing off some of those cells and have to figure out a way to replace them, it's something that normally isn't done. The heart muscles are pretty stable and they have to keep functioning properly if you're going to stay alive, or at least if you're going to be able to pump your blood well enough.
Now, you're not a cardiologist, but here's a question.
Right.
The damage to the heart muscle, okay, let's say that happens to one degree or another to most everyone who's infected with a correct positive test, and we know we've got false positives and false negatives. Is it something that the heart can do, i.e., can it repair its muscle damage? Is this a repairable, recoverable kind of damage, or is this a chronic? Okay, go ahead.
I'm not a cardiologist. I don't really know. I tend to think that the heart isn't the best muscle that repairs itself a lot. I mean, usually is protected and it's probably not damaged that often. So I don't know, but I would tend to think that it would be more likely to be some issue that is not easily repaired. I may be wrong, and it may.
All right, it's an announced, clearly labeled projection. It's a guess. Okay, we don't know, but it's possible. Right. Now, I want to say one thing, and I'm not a pharmacologist or a scientist, but I do know a lot about baseline nutrition, and I can tell you all that CoQ10, it's an enzyme, or is it an amino acid anyway, CoQ10 is very effective, and it's proven, you can find the data, at helping a damaged heart recover. So just keep that in mind. Do your research, look online, CoQ10 and heart attacks, CoQ10 restoring damaged heart muscle. Do your research. I take 600 milligrams a day and have for 20 years. Every single day. And that may be something that could spur an injured heart to recover. I've never had a heart attack. I'm blessed that. But these are big questions. See, this virus, we still don't know. Because of what Henry announced on this program, I think first in the world, and made an issue of the polybasic cleavage site, which means that this virus, unlike a normal influenza virus, can go after any major organ system in the body, from the brain to the kidneys to the heart to the lungs, the liver, all of it. A normal influenza virus will basically go only after the bronchial pulmonary type tissues. That's it. Those cells are targeted. It's a monobasic polycleavage. Or whatever, I got it backwards.
Well, not poly. It's only got one basic
monobasic
amino acid,
cleavage,
right? And so cleavage sites frequently are cleaved by proteases that use a basic amino acid. There's two of them, you know, arginine and lysine are the two basic amino acids out of the 20 that are possible. So the enzyme has to have a certain sequence to recognize the enzyme that typically works for flu. Recognizes a single basic amino acid, and that enzyme that does that cleavage is not widespread. It's in mostly the upper respiratory tract. So that's where the virus can get into cells. So even if its receptor is like on a heart cell, for instance, if the heart cell doesn't have a protease, it's going to cleave at a single basic amino acid and has the same type of amino acids around that basic one to recognize that as a cleavage site. It's not going to cleave it, and the virus needs to have its H in the case of flu, or its spike protein in the case of coronavirus. It needs that surface protein to be cleaved to for the virus to enter the cell. And this cleavage site that's present on SARS-CoV-2, the recognition is it's got a basic amino acid, then it's got any other amino acid, then it's got another basic. So it really requires two basic amino acids, you know, one amino acid apart. And that is present in SARS-CoV-2, the current coronavirus. It's not in the coronavirus from SARS from 17 years ago. It's not in influenza in general, but it is in the high path influenza. The high path influenza has polybasic cleavage sites, and they usually pick those up through recombination. It's actually non-homologous recombination. They end up going to another gene that's got a string of basic amino acids, and they recombine and pull those in to their cleavage site, and then they are just like the SARS SARS-CoV-2, that they can enter multiple cell types. And that's what happens with a high path avian influenza in birds. The virus goes to a bunch of different organs and they end up dying of organ failure because they have too many different organs are infected with the influenza, by the high path influenza. And it does it just for H5 and H7, but that's the reason that even low path that doesn't have the cleavage site is reportable, because those viruses can pick up the polybasic cleavage site and end up, you know, spreading among the poultry and affecting all the organs. So it's a similar type of outcome. The polybasic cleavage site lets the virus go into too many different places in birds, and it almost certainly ends up in death because they're kept at high density and once the virus starts to spread, it goes around very quickly and they die. So that's what the worry is with that. The other concern is Trump is going around and saying that the problem that isn't how he handled the pandemic, that he would give himself an A+ on handling the pandemic, but he would give himself a D on how well he was handling the press coverage. So he's saying that we have 200,000 deaths because the press is poorly covering the pandemic. And I don't even know how he gets from poor press coverage to 200,000 dead Americans. But most people think it has a lot more to do with the handling of the pandemic. And speaking of which, you're like this one. You've always talked about how the virus is aerosolized and it hangs in the air and six feet really isn't enough.
Yeah.
Well, the CDC came out and said that in their update. They updated their website. They said the virus is aerosolized, and that if you're inside, if you don't have good ventilation, as in old schools that Trump tells everybody to go back to, that that might be a problem. And even if you are maintaining 6 feet distance, if you're inside and there's not good ventilation, the virus hangs in the air, and you could get infected.
Yep.
And they put that up, I think, on Friday, and it was gone today.
I know. I got the stories up.
And the reason it was gone is they said it was a mistake, that they didn't mean to put that up, and that, they pulled it down and went back to the old one because it's under review. So again, their goal is not to control the virus. The goal is to control the message about the virus. And, you know, there's a couple different explanations for that. One is that they don't want to say it's aerosolized because they don't have enough N95 masks. And so if they put that out, everybody's going to say, oh, well, if it hangs around the air for a long time, then these masks you're telling us to wear these scarves or these masks that say pump on them, they aren't really going to be that effective. You really need an N95 mask. And, of course, the story from the CDC is, well, you don't really need an N95 mask. And the only ones that really need an N95 mask are
healthcare workers
and those that are exposed to people that have high level of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
others would say that it's because that these schools, the governors are saying you have to have at least 50% capacity, you know, 50% of the students have to be able to go to class in person, and mm-hmm. there's been no funding to do anything about the ventilation for the older schools, and there's been no testing to see how well they clear the virus, if there is virus hanging around, especially if the people that are in the rooms have masks that are, you know, not the most efficient. You know, they're doing 70%.
You know, you'd think, Henry, that they just would buy a simple ozone air purifier for each classroom. It would make a difference, but they're not even doing that. It's just nuts.
No, they're just saying, oh, look at the calendar. Time to go back to school. Don't worry about it.
I know. All right. Terrific report. Covered a lot of science tonight. Very good. Thank you. We'll keep watching it. Talk to you soon. Be well.
Okay. Very good. Take care.
Okay. Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD. And there you go. That's 3 hours to think about. Wow. Back with you tomorrow night. Please prepare as best as you can.